This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. While Milwaukee is often cited as the most segregated metropolitan area in the United States, it's hardly unusual. In most American cities, people of different races live in different neighborhoods. And there's a general pattern. Neighborhoods near the center of a city are home to African Americans and other people of color, while the surrounding suburbs are majority white. But why?
That question is at the heart of Richard Rothstein's new book called The Color of Law. It explores the various avenues that federal, state, and municipal government agencies use to create a system of segregation throughout the United States.
Rothstein will be in Milwaukee to deliver the keynote speech at the 10-year anniversary celebration for Community Advocates Public Policy Institute. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of that event, and their conversation begins with an explanation of de facto and de jure segregation.
De facto segregation is segregation that was created by private activity, by personal prejudice, either of homeowners, perhaps, who wouldn't sell to opposite race neighbors, or real estate agents who steered families to same race neighborhoods, or people's choices about wanting to live with others of the same race, or maybe because African Americans typically have incomes that on average are lower than white incomes and can't easily afford to move to more middle-class communities. All of these individual actions and decisions in which government is not involved comprise de facto segregation, and the government is not permitted, according to the Supreme Court, to remedy de facto segregation, because if something happened by personal choice, it can only be undone by personal choice. On the other hand, de jure segregation is segregation that was created, enforced, maintained by government policy, law, regulation. And in that case, we are obligated to reverse it, to remedy it, because it's a constitutional violation. We have a national myth that, unlike other forms of segregation, as in the 20th century, schools were segregated, or lunch counters, or buses were segregated, or interstate transportation was segregated. Unlike all these other forms of segregation, when it comes to residential segregation, we believe that the government had nothing to do with it. It was all private choice. It's de facto segregation. And therefore, we're not permitted to do anything about it. The reality is that residential segregation in every metropolitan area in this country was explicitly created by federal, state, and local policies that were designed on their face to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live with one another. And because we don't recognize this history, we don't recognize our constitutional obligation to remedy it. If we understood the history, we would have to begin taking the kinds of policy steps that were necessary to desegregate metropolitan areas.
Now, your book, The Color of Law, is really the case for why we do have this responsibility. And you start with a look at San Francisco, specifically the Richmond, California area. What happened there, and why is it kind of a case that extends beyond Richmond specifically?
Well, I focus in the book on places like Richmond, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, because they're thought of as being liberal areas. And I think that if I can explain to people that the government followed policies of explicit segregation in these areas, they may be able to better appreciate that it was done everywhere. In Richmond, there were very few African Americans living in that community before World War II. But during World War II, the defense industry created five shipyards in Richmond. It's a deep water port on the San Francisco Bay, just north of Berkeley. By the end of the war, there were 100,000 workers working in these shipyards. If you consider their spouses and the families, probably 400,000 people came to this small town of 20,000 during the war. If the government wanted the shipyards to continue to be built, it had to create housing for this influx of workers. And it created segregated public housing, creating a segregated pattern in the San Francisco Bay Area that hadn't previously existed. It built shoddy housing for workers along the railroad tracks and near the industrial area if they were black. It was shoddy, temporary, because the city of Richmond announced that any African Americans who came to the city during World War II would have to leave at the end of the war. And it built more stable housing for white workers in the shipyards in the more residential areas where white families were living further inland. I also talk about another defense facility in Richmond, a Ford Motor plant that was converted to defense production during the war. It had been making automobiles during the war. It made tanks and jeeps. At the end of the war, it was converted back to civilian production. And about 10 years later, in the mid-1950s, as happened with so many industrial plants, Ford decided to close the plant and move it to a rural area in what's now Silicon Valley, about 50 miles south of Richmond. The United Auto Workers, the union, negotiated an agreement with Ford that all of the workers who worked at the Ford plant in Richmond could transfer to the new plant in Silicon Valley. The problem was that the white workers could easily transfer. The black workers couldn't because the federal government had another policy of creating suburbs for white workers only around major cities from which African Americans were explicitly excluded. And so there were houses being built in the rural area where the Ford plant and other industrial facilities were being built at that time, but the housing was for white workers only by requirement of the Federal Housing Administration. And as a result, black workers had great difficulty in moving there. The white workers who were able to buy homes in suburbs like those created in Silicon Valley in the mid-1950s bought those homes. They were very inexpensive. They cost about $100,000 in today's money. Today, those homes sell for $400,000, $500,000. They're all over the country, some places more, some places less. The white families who bought those homes in the area where the Ford plant relocated gained over the next couple of generations hundreds of thousands of dollars in wealth, in equity, from the appreciation of their homes. African Americans who were prohibited by federal policy from moving into single-family homes in the suburbs but gained none of that wealth. They continued renting homes, renting apartments in urban areas. The result of that policy is that today, African-American incomes on average are about 60% of white incomes, but average African-American wealth is 10% of white wealth. And that entire disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century. These two policies, the policies of the federal government to create housing, public housing for working class families on a segregated basis, frequently segregating neighborhoods that hadn't previously been segregated, and the FHA's policy of creating all-white suburbs for returning war veterans and for other working class white families from which African Americans were excluded, these two policies created the segregation that we have in every metropolitan area in this country, in some cases reinforced incipient segregation, but nowhere near as powerful what was created by these federal policies. And because of this enormous wealth gap that the policies created, they determine the racial landscape of our metropolitan areas still today.
Now, you just mentioned the FHA. I'm, of course, speaking with you from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which by some estimates is considered the most segregated metropolitan area in the United States. I think a lot of folks here especially are familiar with the practice of redlining, but I was personally less familiar with how involved the Federal Housing Administration was with ensuring that suburbs, neighborhoods remained segregated. How did the FHA work to maintain and cause segregated neighborhoods?
Well, in many cases, it caused segregated neighborhoods. Redlining refers to the Federal Housing Administration's policy of refusing to insure mortgages in African-American neighborhoods, forcing people who lived in those neighborhoods to buy homes on contract, that is on the installment plan where they gain no equity, or simply to rent or to double up in order to maintain housing costs. That's redlining. But the Federal Housing Administration had a much more powerful policy, which was to create single-family home suburbs, giant suburbs, around every metropolitan area in the country. The most famous of these was east of New York City in Levittown. Levitt, the builder, could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes in one place. The only way he could assemble that capital was by going to the Federal Housing Administration, getting approval for his development, on condition that he sold no homes to African Americans. The Federal Housing Administration even required Levitt to place a clause in the deed of every home in Levittown prohibiting a resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. As a result, he was able to take this FHA approval to banks and get guaranteed insured bank loans to build the subdivision. And this went on all over the country in the Milwaukee suburbs, as well as in every metropolitan area. The most well-known symbol of suburbanization in the 1950s was Los Angeles. Many suburbs around Los Angeles were created in this way on a white-only basis by the federal government. This was an explicit federal policy to create segregated metropolitan areas. It combined the refusal to support housing for African Americans in predominantly African American neighborhoods and a refusal to permit African Americans to move to single-family homes in all white suburbs. The subsidy for white families at this period of American history was so enormous that white families could move out of public housing, which they were paying the full cost in rent in urban areas, and with an FHA or a Veterans Administration mortgage, could pay less in their monthly housing costs in single family homes in the suburbs than they were paying for rent in public housing.
One of the more eye-opening things for me in this book was really that public housing was initially intended for middle-class white families in a lot of situations. How did public housing become something of and for the white middle class and move to what it is now and what we look at it as now?
You're absolutely right. That is how public housing began. The first public housing in this country was created during the New Deal in the Roosevelt administration. It was primarily for white working class families, middle class families. They paid the full cost of the housing and their rent. Separate projects were built for African Americans in cities all over the country, creating segregation where it hadn't previously existed. The great African American novelist, poet, playwright Langston Hughes describes how he grew up in a Cleveland neighborhood that was integrated. In the early 20th century, many urban neighborhoods were integrated at that time simply because working people didn't have automobiles to get to work, and most industry was concentrated downtown, and so they had to live in neighborhoods near downtown where they could walk to work or take short streetcar rides. So Langston Hughes grew up in such an integrated neighborhood in Cleveland. He says he dated a Jewish girl in high school. His best friend was Polish. This was typical around the country. Integrated neighborhoods like that. The Public Works Administration demolished integrated housing in that Cleveland neighborhood and created two separate projects, one for African Americans, one for whites, creating a pattern of segregation in Cleveland that otherwise would never have existed in the strength that it does. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, the area near the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the Central Square neighborhood was also a half-black, half-white neighborhood in the 1930s. The federal government demolished housing in that integrated neighborhood to create two separate public projects, one for whites, one for African Americans, creating a pattern of segregation in the Boston metropolitan area that otherwise never would have existed. Well, those projects on a segregated basis continued until the 1950s, when the Federal Housing Administration embarked on the program I mentioned before to move white families out of urban areas, out of public housing and into single family homes in the suburbs. Once that happened, large numbers of vacancies developed in public housing projects for whites. There were long waiting lists in the public housing projects for African Americans. Soon the situation became so conspicuous that the federal government and local housing agencies had to open up the white projects to African Americans. At about the same time, industry left the cities, as in the case of the Ford plant that left Richmond and moved to rural areas. There were fewer and fewer jobs available. The African Americans, who are now almost exclusively living in public housing, became poorer and poorer. Eventually, public housing authorities had to subsidize the rents of families in public housing, and they became the kind of vertical, low-income, concentrated slums that we're familiar with today. Once the rents were no longer sufficient to cover the cost of public housing, maintenance declined on the projects, the government ceased making repairs, and they deteriorated becoming, as I say, the caricature of what we think of as public housing today.
Your book gets into so very many things. It's hard to kind of encapsulate it in a fairly short conversation. But I would like to move to really the final chapter, which looks at a variety of solutions. Do you think there are politically viable solutions at this time, ways of creating more integrated neighborhoods?
Oh, yes, there are many, many more practical solutions. For example, many suburbs now maintain exclusionary zoning ordinances, ordinances that prohibit the construction of townhouses or single-family homes, even on small lot sizes, or apartments, low-rise apartment buildings that maintain their exclusivity. Those zoning ordinances should be prohibited. They were created in large part to preserve a racial exclusivity that was government-created. So the zoning ordinances have an unconstitutional origin. We should require every suburb to permit its fair share of moderate income housing, of market rate housing, of housing for lower income families to create an integrated metropolitan area. We also have two policies for low income families today that reinforce segregation. One of them is the Section 8 voucher program, the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which subsidizes the rents of eligible families, low income families. That program reinforces segregation because a family with a Section 8 voucher is more likely to live in a low-income segregated neighborhood than an equally low-income family without a voucher, and that's because of the program design. It's also because there are few apartments in middle-class areas where the voucher is large enough to rent apartments. So that program needs to be redesigned so that it promotes integration rather than segregation. The other program that we operate is something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. It comes out of the Department of the Treasury. It's a subsidy to builders of low-income housing, and that subsidy also reinforces segregation because builders of low-income housing place it almost entirely in already segregated low-income neighborhoods. They do it because frequently land is cheaper there, most importantly because they don't have to hold a lot of community meetings, face opposition for placing subsidized housing in middle-class communities. But that program could easily be redesigned to place a priority on integration rather than on segregation.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me. And I hope you have a good time here in Milwaukee and have a great talk.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Richard Rothstein is the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. He's also Distinguished Fellow of the Economic Policy Institute and Emeritus Senior Fellow of the Thurgood Marshall Institute at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and a Senior Fellow at the Haas Institute at the University of California, Berkeley.
Rothstein spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of an event celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the Milwaukee-based Community Advocates Public Policy Institute. Rothstein delivers the keynote address tomorrow night, and there's more information at wuwm.com.